I'm Thomas Keneally. As an Australian, the next program has particular significance for me. It tells the story of ANZAC that began as the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps and became a legend, a myth that many Australians feel still defines them today.
Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time to stop rambling, 'cause there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they sent me away to the war.
The story starts on the 25th of April 1915. On that day, just before dawn, Australian troops landed on a narrow beach on the Gallipoli Peninsula in Turkey. They were there as part of an Allied campaign alongside Britain, France and New Zealand to capture territory from Turkey, an ally of Germany. What followed was carnage. On December the 7th that year, 97 years ago in 1915, they began the evacuation of Allied troops. After 8 months of fighting and a loss of more than 130,000 lives, including 8,709 Australians, the Gallipoli campaign had failed. The story of the campaign and its aftermath has captured the imagination of writers, artists, and historians. It also inspired this song, significant to many Australians.
Johnny Turkey was ready. He primed himself well. He showered us with bullets and he rained us with shells. And in 5 minutes flat, he'd blown us all to hell. Nearly blew us right back to Australia.
The presenter today is Sharon Maskell, a journalist born in Britain who now lives in Adelaide, South Australia. And she's with me now. Sharon, you've been working on this program for 5 years. Why is ANZAC so important to you?
Well, for many Australians, ANZAC's not just a story about war and the horrors of war. It's a story about their first test as a nation, as a new nation, post-federation, on the world stage back in 1915. It's about a search for identity, a search for nationhood, amid stories of horror, loss and grief.
Sharon, what are we going to hear in this program?
Well, I'm going to take you on a journey. We start on the Gallipoli Peninsula at ANZAC Cove, where the landings took place. And as we stand on the beach with the sound of the Aegean Sea in the background, you cannot contemplate the carnage and horror of 1915. The only signs are cemeteries, row upon row of white headstones against a clear blue sky. And the stories of those headstones, those stories, that's where we start our journey. Then I'll take you to Melbourne, to Sydney, to my new hometown of Adelaide, and to the nation's capital, Canberra. We'll hear from Australians from a range of backgrounds. We'll hear about Chinese Australians, Iraqi Australians. We also talk to an Indigenous Australian and his 10-year-old son, who's been named ANZAC in recognition of his great-great-grandfather, who fought in the First World War. Now, at times, the journey's going to get tough. We'll hear stories of racism and exclusion, but we'll also hear stories of hope and reconciliation. It's a story about Australia searching for itself and trying to find itself among memories and histories that don't always fit. As a historian and a writer yourself, Thomas, I imagine that's territory you know very well.
Yes, I'm fascinated that Australians apply their imaginations to the story almost continuously, argue about it, and still turn up on the site in Turkey each ANZAC Day. Here on the BBC World Service, we start our journey at ANZAC Cove on the Gallipoli Peninsula in western Turkey.
When I first walked into the first cemetery that we went to, it was this sense of confronting, You just saw the graves, and it was far more confronting than I thought it would be. People who were younger than me or just older than me, and they died.
It's often said that this is the place where Australia loses its innocence. They come here to a place of sordid, shabby suffering, a long and bitter ordeal.
As you stand here with the water lapping at your feet, it's impossible to imagine what went on here. The only marks of the past are the road signs up on the road and the cemetery there at the end, which is where I'm heading now. What's hard to understand if you're not Australian is why this beach, thousands of kilometres away, almost on the other side of the world, carries such significance for Australians still today. Now, I'm meeting Bruce Skates at the cemetery. He's a professor at Monash University in Melbourne, and he spent much of his career walking the battlefields here, connecting Australia to its past.
Where we are at the moment, Sharon, is a place called Hell's Spit. It's where the Australians first come to shore on the 25th of April, in the morning of 1915. Hell's Spit really is an apt name for it. It's a reference, of course, to the fire that those men were exposed to, not so much down here on the beach, but up there in the hills and the gullies where the real fighting takes place. This place, Hell's Spit, is now a cemetery. Over 200 men are buried here. They are set out in neat rows, and in a way that's quite deceptive, because the reality of those burials is they were hurried, they were under fire. The men themselves were in fear every moment that they were here at Gallipoli.
The landings at Hell's Spit and Anzac Cove were just the beginning. For the next 8 months, the Turks fought hard to defend the country where Bruce and I are walking now. There were high casualties, there was disease, and eventually for the Allies, there was defeat. By then, Anzac was more than just an acronym for the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. It was a story, a legend, a soldier, and the name of a place. Today, this part of Turkey is still called Anzac.
It's often said that this is the place where Australia loses its innocence. We've got to remember those young men who went to war. The reality of it is that they set off with that great sense of adventure, and they come here. They come here to a place of sordid, shabby suffering, a long and bitter ordeal. And yet they endure, and yet they manage to prevail here. There is a sense that at this place something historic has happened. I mean, look at this landscape. Look at these hills behind us. Look at these ridges that were held in impossible circumstances. Look at this beach that almost has the names of these men carved on its shore. This is a place to which people have imparted meaning. We've woven it full of significance, and that's something that every visitor notices the moment they come here.
Private Jack Keith Bradley of the 12th Battalion enlisted Brighton, Tasmania on the 20th of August 1914, embarked on the troop ship Geelong on the 20th of October 1914, killed in action on the 25th of April at the landing, aged 19.
Till the day breaks and the shadows flee away.
The stories of those who died at Gallipoli draw thousands of Australians and New Zealanders every year. Over the past 20 years, there's been a huge increase in the numbers of young people in particular who come here for Anzac Day, which is marked on the 25th of April every year. They come here for a memorial service that's held at dawn. And as they wait through the night, they sit by the sea, listening to the stories of those who died.
Most of the place names that we use at Gallipoli are fairly prosaic, like Quinn's Post or Pluggy's Plateau. Lonesome Pine reminds us again of the humanity of these soldiers and the way that language influences. So we've got some readings from Lauren and from Alicia. Okay, so you all ready, guys?
Every year, Bruce brings his students here to show them the battlefields he's got to know so well. For many Australians, coming here is a pilgrimage. They call Anzac sacred, a kind of civic religion conveyed through monuments and the annual rituals of Anzac Day, when thousands take to the streets to attend services at dawn and watch veterans marching in uniform. Talking to Bruce's students here, it's clear that Anzac has significance to them. But they're also asking questions. They want to know more about its significance today.
I think we're just so proud of what our men did. They travelled so far away from home. They left this beautiful country we have of Australia and came to fight a war that most of us didn't know much about, an enemy we didn't know much about. And in reality, most of the men probably didn't really even know what we were fighting for. So, yeah.
I originally came across here very sceptical about the whole legend. But I guess for Australia, it's so attached because even though we came up against something that decimated, you know, some families, it removed all of the males from their family. And yet Australia still survived and still kept going. And I think that's why we're so attached to it.
So what does it mean to you being here?
To me, when I first walked into the first cemetery that we went to, it was this sense of confronting people who are younger than me or just older than me, and they died. And for me, coming here is about learning about what happened and looking at even some of the other elements, like the Turkish side that's not really discussed so much in Australian schools.
So for you, it's not just an Australian story, it's more than that.
Yeah, no, I came here because I'm very interested in what Australians don't talk about, the Indian graves down at Anzac Cove, the Gurkhas and the Indians and the African troops. They're not recognised in the same way. Even the Indigenous soldiers, you know, they had pay disputes. The government didn't want to pay them the same at the end. They didn't want to give the pensions or the land, and that's what's not there, not talked about.
This is a place that few people see. It's the French cemetery on the Gallipoli Peninsula, and today as I sit here I'm alone. The only sound is the cicadas and the wind cutting through twisted metal. The metal marks the graves of other nationalities who fought here alongside Australia. I can see the names of Hamoud, Bliko and Taoua, men without surnames from French colonial Africa, their stories unknown. Anzac is an Australian story, a story of courage, mateship and resilience. But could it be something more? Could it be about mateship in a wider context, connecting Australians to other nations like New Zealand, Britain, Turkey and these men from North Africa? According to Bruce Gates, it doesn't have to be nationalistic.
Yes, 1915 is always seen as the birthplace of the nation. It's here that Australia was born. Well, 2015, 100 years on, maybe that's the time for Australians to say, we've grown up, we're mature now. And I think in that maturity, we can reflect on the human cost of war, not just see it through a narrow nationalistic prism, but acknowledge all the nations that suffered here, acknowledge the loss to Turkey during this war, the loss to all of the armies that fought in this war. I think now is the time to make a statement about the universal loss and tragedy of war. It's not a time to celebrate nationhood.
How important is it then that Australia doesn't resort to a nationalist interpretation of its past? How important is it that, as you say, it embraces the multicultural elements of its history?
Nationalism is, of course, founded on a series of exclusions. And really what we see in the Anzac legend is often an apotheosis, a celebration of the white Australian male. And yet, really, it's not even true to the historical experience. Look at these graves over here. There's an Indian troop buried here. There are troops from Sri Lanka buried here. There are troops from Algeria buried all across the sectors who served with the French. This is a war that consumed nations. So really this is a loss for entire communities. It's not simply an Australian story. And I think by acknowledging that it's not just an Australian story, we'll actually have a much richer and deeper understanding of where we sit within a global world.
Back in Australia, there's been resistance to some of the ideas that Bruce Gates is proposing. The idea that Anzac can be Australian and reach out to others, also affected by the loss and devastation of war, is complex. It's hard to summarise in a headline or one version of the story.
Australian Veterans of the Great War, Oral History Project. Interview with Mr. Fred Farrell.
And in one night, out of a division of about 10,000, they lost 5,500 and odd casualties. It was the first time that the Australians had crossed no man's land and was possibly the most disastrous. Because you didn't know what was going to happen. and you conjure up in your mind all sorts of things, and like lots and lots of them did happen, they just got to lay there and die.
In the 1980s, Alastair Thompson interviewed a number of Australian veterans from the First World War, including Fred Farrell, who died in 1991. Alastair is no stranger to the complexity of Anzac and the voices missing from the story.
Soldiers' experiences that didn't fit get written out of that story. So all the men who get emasculated during the First World War by shell shock or whatever, people like Fred Farrell, who I interviewed, whose picture's up on the wall behind you, he's being told that these are brave Anzac heroes. He was a mess. He was emasculated. He was terrified. And so he doesn't feel he fits. He doesn't go to Anzac Day marches. Personally, he feels written out of and silenced by the Anzac story.
And whoever thought up celebrating Anzac Day, which was had nothing to recommend it in a way, first of all, we were invading another country, Turkey. We were invading another country. We were not being invaded. Secondly, it finished in a defeat. And if there's one thing Australians don't like, it doesn't matter what it's at, whether it's war or football or horse racing or anything, if there's one thing they don't like, it's being beaten. And they were beaten on Gallipoli. So they celebrated it for another reason. That was to cultivate a spirit of war in the community.
Whereas other guys that I've interviewed grab hold of and use the Anzac story as a way of making themselves feel good about themselves, because actually it's a positive and affirming story if it's close enough to your own experience. So that's one set of exclusions. I suppose the other big one is around gender, because clearly it's a story that hasn't got a place, an easy place for women and for nurses, for example, or for women who are working on the home front in the sort of interwar years. And it's not until much, much, much later that, for example, women who are in the Women's Land Army get to be allowed to march on Anzac Day.
You've talked about gender, you've talked about male soldiers that didn't fit the mould. But why was it, though, that multiculturalism didn't fit into the story that was told at that time?
I guess that's part of the fact that actually multiculturalism isn't on people's agenda, and it's a white Australia policy for the first two-thirds of the 20th century. If you look at any of the representations of Anzacs through the first two-thirds of the 20th century, they're white men with chiselled jaws. So, you know, the Chinese Australians, including guys who were snipers at Gallipoli, you don't see their images as part of the iconography. The German Australians who joined up often changed their names from Schneider to Smith or Schmidt to Smith. You know, you don't see that as well. Those sort of ethnic groups are marginalised. So actually, despite the fact that significant enlistment in the First World War of people from Chinese Australian or German Australian or Italian Australian backgrounds, you wouldn't know it, basically. It's written out of the story.
It's hard to know when, given the sheer number of Anzac Day ceremonies across Australia, but at some point there was a change in those taking part. At this year's march in Melbourne, for example, I saw young cadets marching from a range of backgrounds. They were male and female. They were new Australians from India, Africa, and the Middle East. But although Anzac appears to be more inclusive, some say there's more to be done to convey mateship in multicultural terms. The first step is getting the story straight and correcting the historical record, including Australians who weren't necessarily white with chiselled jaws.
Billy Singh was a country boy, shy, quiet, retiring, spent all his time shooting rabbits and kangaroos for the table, a crack shot. He was recognised for his ability. The old colonial attitude still prevailed in those days. And if you weren't white Anglo-Saxon, you weren't considered fit for the armed forces, which was a great shame because fellows of Billy Singh's ilk were fine soldiers. Excellent, excellent.
This is Ray Fogg, and I've come to Queensland to meet him. I want to know more about an Anzac soldier who had Chinese ancestry and served with Ray's battalion during the First World War. He was called the Gallipoli Sniper, and he served in France and Belgium as well as Turkey. But he died in poverty and obscurity. His name was Billy Singh.
He was a man of great temperament, tremendous patience. To be a sniper, you have to lie in the one place for ages and ages and not move. He even outwitted the Turks. The Turks had their own specialised sniper to hunt him down, and he got him. There was no beating him.
And what did he do in France? I mean, he must have been there right till the end of the war.
He was there from 1916 till 1918. He was a patrol leader and into Belgium, where he was awarded the Belgian Croix de Guerre on top of the Distinguished Conduct Medal he received at Gallipoli. He was also recommended for a military cross, but once again, the red tape.
Red tape? What do you mean by red tape? Was it because of his cultural background?
Mostly. It was, once again, it's a colonial decree that ordered these things, and he was a Chinaman. He'd had several medals, so it wasn't considered that he should be awarded another one, even though he really deserved it. Just the old attitude of prejudice that slowed it all down.
So when he came back to Australia, how was he treated? Was he treated like a war hero? Was he treated well?
He was granted a soldier settlement site in the worst country you've ever seen, out near the desert, trying to make a living out of it, which was a failure. He tried mining, which was a failure, and he just went downhill to menial jobs, labouring, until he moved to Brisbane, trying to patch up his life to no avail, and unfortunately died in a decrepit boarding house in South Brisbane in 1943. A broken man. All he had left was 4 shillings and a couple of pounds owed to him by his employer at the time.
This is the Brisbane cemetery where Billy Singh is buried. It's not easy to find his grave. It's just a plaque on the ground with a small spray of flowers in the section that used to have unmarked graves. But there are plans now to build a memorial here. His story has brought together historians, politicians, and members of the community. Although he died in obscurity, his legacy is shifting attitudes. He's a missing piece, restored to the Anzac story.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. After the news, join me, Thomas Keneally, for part two of Anzac. Our journey continues to Sydney, where we hear how Anzac has been dragged into racist violence.
For me, I can only remember the strongest feeling that I had, and that was a feeling of shame and resentment towards all those who were taking part. And I think that was the overwhelming feeling of people in Australian society.
And we find how Indigenous Australians are reclaiming their piece of the Anzac story.
When I think of Anzac and Gallipoli, I think of my great-grandfather and all the grandfathers and all the fellows who went over and fought for Australia. I think being an Aboriginal family, it's a great honour to be connected to the Anzacs, but also proud of my great-grandfather, who was an Anzac.
That's Anzac here on the BBC World Service after the news.
In 1915, Australian troops fought at Gallipoli and died in their thousands.
For a young nation, this was a huge cost for a generation of Australians to bear.
And their tragic fate is still remembered.
They left this beautiful country we have of Australia and came to fight a war. In reality, most of the men probably didn't really even know what we were fighting for.
The Anzacs became a symbol of national identity.
Anzac was more than just an acronym for the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. It was a story, a soldier, and the name of a place. Today, this part of Turkey is still called Anzac.
But does the legend still have a place in modern Australia?
1915 is always seen as the birthplace of the nation. It's here that Australia was born. Well, 2015, 100 years on, maybe that's the time for Australians to say, we've grown up.
Anzac, online at bbcworldservice.com.
Coming up after the news, we return to Anzac, the story of the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps and their legacy from the battlefields of Gallipoli, which reverberates in the streets of Sydney today. I'm Thomas Keneally. Join me as the going gets tough in a battle which still affects the hearts and minds of Australians today. Anzac, after the news.
BBC News with Jonathan Izard. Almost 200 nations at UN climate talks in Qatar have agreed to extend until 2020 the only legally binding plan for combating global warming, the Kyoto Protocol, which expires at the end of this year. The extension is an interim measure pending negotiations on a new deal due to take effect in 2020. Delegates also agreed that rich nations should take steps to compensate poorer ones for the damage they've done to the world's climate, although no figures were mentioned. The Italian Prime Minister Mario Monti has told the President, Giorgio Napolitano, he plans to resign. He said he no longer feels he has the confidence of Parliament after Silvio Berlusconi's People of Freedom Party withdrew its support earlier this week. Mr. Monti, an economist who heads a non-elected cabinet of technocrats, said he will try to pass a budget and financial stability law before standing down. The Egyptian military has warned of disastrous consequences if the rival political forces there fail to resolve their differences through dialogue. A spokesman said the army would not allow Egypt to be dragged into what he called a dark tunnel. Military sources stressed this did not mean the army would intervene to take power. Meanwhile, talks on Egypt's future have been taking place. Syrian opposition groups say a senior military officer who defected from President Bashar al-Assad's army has been chosen to head a new unified rebel military command dominated by Islamists. Brigadier Salim Idris was elected by 30 military and civilian members of a joint command that was formed on Friday after talks in the Turkish city of Antalya, attended by Western and Arab security officials. But senior commanders of the rebel Free Syrian Army told the BBC they did not recognise the new command. The former South African president, Nelson Mandela, has been admitted to hospital in Pretoria. The office of the current president, Jacob Zuma, said his admission was for tests and that the 94-year-old was doing well and there was no cause for alarm. BBC News.
I'm Thomas Keneally, and now for part two of ANZAC, our journey into the stories and memories that many Australians feel are the foundation of their national identity. We started in Turkey, where Australian troops were part of a failed campaign to take control of the Gallipoli Peninsula in 1915. We heard how the story of what happened has become a disputed legend. To many Australians, though, it's the foundation of values they believe in: mateship, resilience, and courage under fire. Now, Sharon, you're going to take us to Sydney and the suburbs, where there were riots in 2005 that divided communities. And why there? How does it relate to ANZAC?
What's interesting about that Sydney suburb of Cronulla, Thomas, is, as we'll hear, the outcome is not what you'd think. At the time, there were riots, there was violence, there was racism. But now there's something else, something that has significance for the ANZAC story.
Thank you, Sharon. You're listening to the BBC World Service. And now, for the final part of today's documentary, we return to ANZAC.
ABC News. Police say the racist attacks on a Sydney beach today were done under a mob mentality. Thousands of people...
The New South Wales Premier Morris Yemma has condemned an attack on an ambulance during violent clashes in Sydney South.
Residents of Cronulla say around 30 to 40 carloads of men converged on the suburb and went on a violent rampage. This man says the group used baseball bats to smash car windows throughout the suburb.
We've heard stories, we don't know how, if all of it's true, but you just have to look on this street and every car's been hit.
The government is simply pussyfooting. What they need to do is mobilise hundreds of police, and if they don't have enough police in New South Wales at the moment, then bring them in from interstate.
It's about time people took the stand and said, this isn't right. It's not right. What I'm saying is that it's racial intolerance. We've got to find ways of getting on with one another.
The Islamic Friendship Association of Australia says it's appalled at yesterday's violence. The president, Kesar Trad, says he hopes those responsible are brought to justice.
In early December 2005, a row broke out between a group of surf lifesavers and some young men from migrant backgrounds. Over the next 10 days, the violence escalated, fueled by a media frenzy and text messages urging thousands onto the beach and out onto the streets. The riots were organised and openly racist. At one point, the Australian flag was torn down and burnt. Others wore flags like uniforms and called themselves ANZACs. There was outrage among Australian war veterans and the wider community. Don Rowe is president of the Return Services League in New South Wales, the RSL, as it's commonly known. He's also a veteran of the war in Vietnam.
We're absolutely disgusted. That's the last thing that ANZAC is interpreted as being. The ANZAC spirit is a mateship, looking after one another, believing what you're doing. You certainly don't go around waving flags and call yourself an ANZAC, then turn around building people up. That's totally opposite to what ANZAC is.
But why ANZAC then? Why was it that they associated ANZAC with racist violence?
Good question. Maybe they thought that here's a way to promote white supremacy and telling yourself we're ANZACs. I don't know, which is not, of course. It's not the ANZACs at all. We were multicultural, literally, when we fought at Gallipoli. There was Aboriginals, there was people from other nations, Chinese descendants were there, there was a number of other descendants. So that defeats the whole purpose of what ANZAC's all about.
Today, there's no sign of the violence that erupted here. I'm standing outside the RSL club building where the boy, he was 16 at the time, climbed up and stole the flag. He brought it down here, just in front of where I'm standing, and it was set on fire. There was outrage among Australians. There were demands that the boy, from a Lebanese family, should be sent to jail. When Don Rowe and his colleagues tried to work with him, asking him to carry the flag in the next Anzac Day march, things turned particularly nasty, and Don was threatened with violence.
Threats of violence, threat of abuse. You'll never walk down the street of this young fella. I'll make sure you'd never walk down. I'll stop him, kick his head in. Don't you dare do that. My great-great-grandfather, he served in Gallipoli, and how dare you do this? They just didn't see the whole point of what it was about, for goodness sake. It was an opportune time to turn a young fella's life around and help him understand what the flag means to Australians. And anyway, on the second day it turned around, we got just as many phone calls supporting us because of the negativity that was coming through. People suddenly started to stand up and say, no, what you're doing is right, you've got to do it. Don't let those mongrels talk you out of doing it.
Given the threats against you, why did you push forward with this when clearly there was so much antagonism and threats of violence at the time?
I think it goes back to the ANZAC spirit, you're helping one another, you're helping your mate, you stand by people. And here was a great opportunity to live up to that ANZAC tradition, if you like, that here's somebody who was down, but God, you're not going to crucify him for the rest of his life, are you? You're going to say, okay, mate, this is what the ANZAC was all about, this is what the Australian flag was all about, I'll help you. You're young, you've got your whole life ahead of you, you're not going to screw it up over one thing that you've done, which was absolutely stupid and brainless and edged on by the crowd that was there. So, okay, I can see an opportune time for me as a human being to help a fellow human being and a young kid, as simple as that.
But later that same day, Don Rowe had no choice. He couldn't guarantee his safety or anyone else's who'd be marching that Anzac Day. So he backed down. Instead, he gave the boy a chance to learn about Australia's military past by walking the Kokoda Track in Papua New Guinea, a World War II site that also has significance for many Australians. Today, the community has moved on and the flag is back on top of the RSL club building near the beach. I expected to find division there, but it's not what the local people are saying. One of them is called Sam Al-Maliki, a former refugee from Iraq who spent time in an immigration detention centre when he first arrived in Australia. He says Anzac means something to him as a new Australian, and the community's moved on since the riots of 2005.
The Anzac story and the sacrifices that the Anzacs undertook represents a fundamental pillar of Australian society, Australian history, and the national pride that brings all of us together. And so naturally, in these events, we often see these kind of national treasures are dragged into the conflicts and the confrontations that happen between groups in any society, and some will use it in their favour and others use it to bring down and so forth. So it can be used both ways, and that's what we saw here.
Do you think Anzac still is a target then? I mean, could we see this kind of thing happen again?
I don't think so, and I think Anzac, we see every year, is embedded more and more into who we are as a nation, and particularly how young people feel about their sense of national identity. People of my generation have gone through a full process of living through the full-ranging diversity and cultural mosaic that Australian society is. And they don't necessarily see one another on the basis of their cultural background, but see each other on the basis of what brings them together, a shared experience, going to school together, celebrating key events that are in the national calendar, such as Australia Day, marking key events such as Remembrance Day and Anzac Day. Those kind of things unite people, I think, and put everything else into perspective. And that's what we're seeing more and more of. Australia is increasingly more and more diverse. So rather than becoming a reality we're trying to avoid, it is a reality we're accepting more and more so. And that's why I think we're a far more mature society for it.
Today I've returned to my hometown of Adelaide, the place where my journey began 5 years ago now. And as I stand here in the Memorial Gardens in the centre of the city, there's something that bothers me. There must be 50 plaques and monuments nearby. There are memorials to women, to soldiers who served in Vietnam. There's even a memorial to war horses nearby. But there's no mention of Indigenous Australians, even though we now know that hundreds went away to fight in the First World War and in conflict since then. Now I'm here to meet Bill Denny. He's a veteran of the war in Vietnam, and he's part of a campaign to have a new memorial built here, a war memorial to Indigenous Australians.
I personally believe the Aboriginal people have been treated appallingly in our nation's history, and this is one area where it's not too late to do something. Surveys with the Aboriginal community, as we lead up to the centenary of Anzac in 2015, they were saying that Anzac is a party to which we've never been invited.
So what's being done then to try to correct the historical record? I mean, we're standing here in these memorial gardens, that there are plans for some kind of Indigenous memorial here, aren't there?
Yeah, yes, not far, only 100 metres or so across behind me there, will be an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander War Memorial. It'll be the first of its type in Australia. The other thing too is running concurrently is the Register of Aboriginal Veterans of South Australia project, and we've now got many hundreds of names of South Australian veterans that we didn't know of before. One of the lovely parts about that, there was a chap who we found who was alive and, you know, in his 90s, and he said, "I never ever bothered applying for my medals because I sort of thought it was a white man's war." And when we set him down with his community and told him how much we valued his contribution, and he asked us to get his medals, and we had the pleasure of presenting him to him last year. Now, he earned those medals in 1945. And that dear man just wept and wept and wept. And he said it was just the most wonderful things. And there's a photograph of him with these beautiful shiny new medals that were minted in 1945 and presented in 2011.
So far, 378 names have been added to the Register of Aboriginal Veterans. And that's just here in South Australia. There are many more names to be recorded nationally across the rest of the country. When war broke out in 1914, Aborigines weren't officially allowed to enlist, and like other Australians from non-European backgrounds, they had to keep their ancestry a secret if they wanted to sign up. Now, one man who did sign up was called Arthur Walker, and his great-grandson, John Lukowiak, is determined that his story should be remembered. He's even called one of his five children Anzac.
His name was Arthur Thomas Walker, and he grew up in the southeast of South Australia. His Aboriginal language group was Ramangeri, and the family talked about him being an Anzac and going to Gallipoli and fighting, and that was always special to us, and it was always special to me from a very young age, you know, knowing that, and my mum always bringing us to the Anzac March. And when I got older, I thought, when I have children, I want to name one of my sons Anzac. It's just a tradition that we carry. He's actually Anzac the Fifth in our family, and the name's fitting for him, and he plays footy. All the boys play football, and he's the one who's in the bottom of the packs and getting the ball, and the name suits him, I think.
So tell me more about your great-grandfather, because when he enlisted, he wasn't allowed to say he was Aboriginal.
No. When he enlisted, Aboriginal people weren't allowed to join the Army or the Air Force and the Navy. And when we went through his records, and it's got nationality and it's got Australian, and when they describe him again, it's got him dark complexion, but nowhere it's written Aboriginal. So But then in times of battle, and they all united. I think that was the beautiful thing, that he was seen as a soldier, you know, not as being classified as being Aboriginal. So when they were fighting and over in Gallipoli, he was one of the soldiers, you know, and he had his mates. And some of the Aboriginal fellows who did come back from Gallipoli did find it quite difficult when they did get home, because in the army they were treated as one, and then they come back to Australia and they were treated again differently. The good thing to come out of that is a lot of those people did get support from the Army and the Air Force and the Navy, and they were the ones who set up a lot of the Aboriginal co-ops and Aboriginal organisations today to say, you know, we're Australian, we fought for Australia, we should be treated like everybody else.
Now, I must talk to this young gentleman. So your name's Anzac. And why were you given that name?
When people say my name, they remember my great-grandfather.
And that's important to you?
Yep. He was very special to us.
Really? Why was he so special to you?
Because he fought for Australia, and he was my nana's dad.
He was your nana's dad?
Yep.
In Canberra, millions of dollars have been allocated for events marking the Anzac centenary, and the pressure is on to get the story right. There are plans for a travelling exhibition, for a theatre production called Black Digger about an Indigenous soldier, and there'll be a book of 100 stories about Australians from a range of backgrounds and their experiences of the First World War. For Angus Houston, the chair of the Anzac Centenary Advisory Board, getting the story right requires careful negotiation.
Well, I think it's important, very important, that we get the story right. And I think you'll find that our historians will work assiduously and very rigorously to tell the story, warts and all. I think one of the very important things that we have to do here is get the balance right between the great values that were demonstrated throughout the Gallipoli campaign and the war on the Western Front, and the costs that were borne as a consequence of that service for such a long period of time. I mean, we had 330,000 people go overseas. 62,000 were killed in action. Somewhere in the order of about 150,000 were wounded in action. And of course, a large number of people came back from the war to where the consequences for the rest of their lives. Indeed, many of them died prematurely as a consequence of their service. So for a young nation which went into the war with less than 5 million people, this was a huge cost for a generation of Australians to bear.
What about new Australians, though, who've only come to Australia relatively recently? People from war-torn areas of Africa, the Middle East, Afghanistan. What is a centenary going to mean to them?
Well, the centenary for them, we need to enhance their understanding of what Anzac's all about, because it is fundamental to the Australian character. So, number one, we need to provide due recognition for everybody who participated in the Great War. But we also need to enhance the understanding of all Australians in terms of the legacy that the Anzacs have given them. And that includes not just the Anglo-Saxon Australians, it includes all of our communities, the Sudanese, Ethiopians, the Timorese, the Iraqis, the Afghans, everybody. But at the same time, I think we need to get a better understanding of their experience. A lot of them have come from war-torn countries. In fact, many of them have flown from catastrophic and difficult circumstances. And we probably need to hear their stories. To my way of thinking, the Anzac tradition, the Anzac spirit, has a great unifying effect across our community if it's properly understood. So one of the most important things is to enhance the understanding of what Anzac is all about.
Back here in Turkey, the Anzac story's already moved on to take account of other countries' experiences of war. This is the seaport of Çanakkale. It's just across the water from Gallipoli. I can see the peninsula. across the Dardanelles Straits there. Now, when you come here as an Australian, it's clear that the Anzac story has a new significance. Today it's about connection with the local people, about a shared history that's more than military. Here, the Anzac story's moved on. It's no longer just about the past, it means something new in the present.
Of course, in the past, Australia and Turkey were enemies. They fought against each other in Gallipoli, but now we're good friends. And everything has changed.
Aze Kemagolu is assistant professor at the university here, and today she's invited Bruce Skates to visit with his students from Melbourne. Talking to Aze and her colleagues here, the Anzac story is still evolving. For them, the events of 1915 are also about resilience, about standing up to an enemy who tried to invade their country. But today it's also about reconciliation, about mateship with Australians, regardless of cultural background.
Actually, Australia is a multicultural country. It's a country of great diversity as far as ethnicity and race. I have seen this when I was in Australia, so I love that multicultural environment. I enjoyed it so much. And now you can see the students, can you hear their voice, like they are sharing their experiences with our students, and they are from all over the country. In Turkey, and you know, this shows the friendship and the reconciliation, and hope that is the same in the Anzac Day remembrances in Australia.
Gathering at this hour, we join symbolically with those men and women who have served our country in war.
There is no greater honour for me to speak for and with Australians and New Zealanders than here at Gallipoli, on the land in whose warm bosom our sons lie at peace.
Over the past 5 years, I've attended Anzac Day services here on the Gallipoli Peninsula and back in Australia. I've stood in the cold light of dawn and thought about those who died and what they died for. The Australians, the New Zealanders, the Turks and the British. Today, I've come to the British Memorial at Cape Helles on the peninsula, a needle of stone pointing up into the sky. And there's a number on one side. It says 20,763. The number of British who died here and have no grave. I think about my own great-grandfather, who fought on the Western Front in the First World War. He was lucky. He made it home. I think of my grandmother, who worked for the Red Cross during the Second World War. She fell pregnant by an American fighter pilot, a grandfather I never knew. In searching for Anzac, I've also thought about my own identity and the legacy of war.
The story of what happens here, the hardships that are endured here, the common fears, the common tragedies, the common loss here, all of that unites us all. Many people make their way to Anzac of Maltese descent, of Lebanese descent, of British descent, of New Zealand descent, and these people, by coming to this place, recognise a part of a wider history. They relate their family's story to this place. And indeed, I think that the journey, the pilgrimage, has become a way of discovering or asserting a form of Australianness that isn't so exclusive, that's inclusive, that can incorporate the stories of many different nations. And that's part of the challenge, I think, of the Anzac mythology today.
And that's Professor Bruce Skates. I'm Thomas Keneally, and as an Australian, my own relationship with Anzac is also shifting and evolving. Now, one thing I want to ask you, Sharon, is whether being British was an issue when you were making this documentary. One thing you didn't talk about was the fact that the British have been blamed for sending Australians to their deaths at Gallipoli.
If we think back to the 1980s, there was a film called Gallipoli, which had a defining effect on the way that Australians think about the Gallipoli campaign and what happened. Now, that film starred Mel Gibson, and it had an enormous impact in building antagonism against Britain for what happened. In that movie, for example, there's a scene where the British are shown drinking tea on the beach while Australians die for them. Now, what's interesting is that that scene has since been shown to be historically inaccurate, yet in one of the interviews that I recorded for this documentary, someone brought it up, and there are still many Australians who believe it to be true even today. Thomas, what did you think of the film Gallipoli when you saw it?
Well, having read a lot about that campaign, I knew that when the Australians were about to be slaughtered at Lone Pine, and Mel Gibson says in response to the question, where are the British? And he replies, the British are drinking tea on the beach. I knew that that was a nonsense reply. It appealed to Australian Republican sentiment, but it was a falsity because the British were dying in great numbers trying to capture a town named Krithia, and also on the beaches adjacent to the Anzacs.
Do you feel that Anzac is part of your identity?
It is part of the way I understand myself. Australia is a strange nation in that it's non-militaristic. It prefers citizen soldiers over regulars. And you never see an armed soldier in the street. It's a blessed country in that regard. But I think there was a great deal the Australians wanted to do at Gallipoli. Even my generation grew up with a certain shame about convictism, that we were the only liberal democracy on earth that began as a purpose-designed penal settlement. And I think a lot of those boys who died at Gallipoli or served at Gallipoli wanted to show that the Australians had fibre, that their origins did not condemn them to baseness. They wanted to show that they had superior initiative and superior valour and also superior egalitarianism. Their refusal to salute British officers was a trick that was pursued right up into World War II, in which my father was a soldier and seems to have spent most of his time not dealing with the threat of Rommel and the Afrika Korps in North Africa, but avoiding saluting British officers. And I think that idea of individuality, that was one of the most persistent myths of Gallipoli. It's interesting to me, too, that if we can look back to 1901, Australia, an enormous country, London to Moscow is its girth. It federated all these former colonies into one nation peaceably. And it's as if we look out to Gallipoli, as if we're almost regret that peacefulness and reach out to the Dardanelles for the drama and blood myth that's missing in Federation. Well, sadly, time's up, and you've been listening to Anzac here with me, Thomas Keneally, and with reporter Sharon Maskell on the BBC World Service.